Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do elite journalism companies truly live up to the ethical standards they profess? And what sort of behavior is justified by those who believe truth and objectivity are being shortchanged in news gathering? Daniel Simpson was still in his 20s when he was hired away from Reuters to cover the Balkans for the New York Times in 2002. But what might have seemed to be a dream job proved almost immediately disappointing to Simpson. He felt his beat was overlooked by the news desk in New York and came to believe many of his colleagues there willingly suspended critical analysis of the buildup to America's war in Iraq. So he gave notice, setting his sights instead on truly changing the world with a music festival he hoped would unite Balkan youth. He filed final stories with the Times he now admits were rife with faked quotes and information he gathered by watching TV news. Daniel Simpson candidly shares the whole story in his new memoir, A Rough Guide to the Dark Side. He's in town to speak this afternoon at the Mayborn School of Journalism at UNT, and he will speak Sunday at a Writer's Garret open house at Lucky Dog Books in Dallas. Daniel, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris.
So what kinds of assumptions did you have about the kind of journalism done by the New York Times before you got a paycheck from the New York Times?
Well, the New York Times likes to think of itself as the best newspaper in the world. And I suppose, feeling very full of myself as a young journalist who'd just been hired by them, I like to think that reflected well on me and that made me a great journalist and that it would mean that I was going to do groundbreaking work that would influence a lot of people's view of the world. I didn't really think in any detail whatsoever about what that actually meant in practice. I just liked to assume that somehow by association with this institution, I would do good work and that by definition, they were doing it already. And I think a lot of journalists go about their job without thinking in too much detail what is involved in the selection of information, the prioritization of certain facts and the framing of the news stories that they write. And at the New York Times, I think that was as true as anywhere I've ever seen.
Yeah, reading the book, it drove home for me the fact that it's really easy to get comfortable enough with what you're doing and say, we are too busy to stop now and sort of ask what this is.
And that's becoming even more the case in every newsroom. I mean, everywhere around the world, journalists are starved of resources, expected to do more and more work. You know, they're feeding Twitter feeds, blog posts, videos, podcasts, filing stories several times a day as if they work for a newswire, even though they work for a weekly or monthly magazine. And they don't have as much time as they did to find things out. So they certainly don't have time to sit around and ask themselves, are we living up to our ethical standards? Are we actually pursuing somebody else's agenda rather than what we might think of as the news agenda, which is this strange beast that everybody somehow assumes is either objective or self-defining, but in reality is defined by journalists in the choices that they make.
What drew you to journalism in the first place? Did you expect to change the world with your writing?
It's a good question because I liked to think that I would, but I think, to be honest, I became a journalist because I wasn't sure what else to do. I wanted to do something that would enable me to be a witness to many different things, and being a reporter seemed to give me an excuse to go and talk to anybody I wanted to and to go to all manner of different situations, poke my nose in, have a look around, have an opinion perhaps, and change the scene in which I was working a lot of different times. But I lived abroad when I was young. I grew up partly in Holland. And so I always had this sense that living abroad was not an alien thing. And I thought it would be an exciting way to live, to go and live in different countries. So I did expressly want to be a foreign correspondent. And I suppose, based on a lot of the journalists I saw when I was growing up, I had this idea that to be a war correspondent, for example, or reporting from a situation somewhere far away that people didn't understand so well, would help the readers or the viewers or the listeners to my work to become more informed and to try and put pressure on people to stop whatever injustice it was that I'd been drawn to reporting on. So I suppose I did have those assumptions, but I'd never really thought them through. I just, again, you know, had this idea that because I was doing the work, wherever I got sent, that would be the inevitable consequence, but it didn't quite pan out that way. I was hired to work for Reuters, as you said in the introduction, and Reuters is an enormous international news organization with offices pretty much in every country on the planet. But their primary business isn't reporting on conflicts, famines, struggles for natural resources, people's population transfers in response to all of that, refugee crises, whatever it may be. It's actually to report for banks. I mean, Reuters makes its money selling trading terminals for whether it be currency trading, stock trading, bond trading, and their main competitor is Bloomberg, which specializes entirely in financial information. And that's what the bulk of the people there are reporting on. So I was initially sent to Frankfurt as a stock market reporter and was nowhere near any of this righting of wrongs that I thought I'd set out to at least contribute to, if not be successful in.
So your beat in the Balkans was important enough to the New York Times to have a correspondent there, but as you discovered, not important enough to get much real attention from the people deciding what would actually make the paper.
It was a very interesting time. I mean, I was hired right at the start of 2002, and I didn't think this through at all. But after 9/11, the US news media was not so interested in anything other than the war on terrorism, and that was an inevitable reality. The US elite, the government, was very focused on this to the extent that there really wasn't much dissent about what foreign policy should be in the aftermath of the attacks on New York and Washington. Again, naively assumed that this would lead to some period of questioning in which American policymakers and certainly the news media would be asking whether there was something about American foreign policy that needed to change to not appease people who had attacked this country, but to at least disarm some of these people of the arguments they were using to recruit people into terrorist causes. And I had assumed in some way that would spread very quickly, and the questions that Americans were asking would get reflected in news coverage and in policymaking. And instead, no, there was pretty much a uniform agreement that it was necessary to start bombing Afghanistan. And before long, there was talk of invading Iraq. And that was what the paper was full of, and the ramifications of these policies in different countries around the Middle East. The cooperation with Central Asian republics in which the US was trying to set up military bases. That was what they wanted to have in their foreign pages, and there wasn't really much space for anything else. But the Balkans were important to the United States. There were tens of thousands of American soldiers in Bosnia and Kosovo. And again, I guess I was pretty naive. I thought, here we are in a situation where I can see on the ground that Western involvement has not really solved the problems in former Yugoslavia. It's actually in some ways contributed to the problems. And I'm looking forward to the opportunity to writing at great length why Western policy is not as successful as it claims to be. Unfortunately, I hadn't realized what that unanimity of opinion in the US was going to mean at that time, which, I mean, firstly, that there wasn't any space to start talking about Balkan affairs because that was yesterday's news. Something of great interest in the 1990s to Americans, but no longer so. Secondly, critiquing government policy was suddenly not the order of the day whatsoever, and there wouldn't be much space for it, whoever I'd been, but certainly not as a 27-year-old who'd just been hired. And then there was this whole question of the assumptions that were being made on the part of the news media at that time, that there was this assumption of the justice of American policy, the justness and the justice, the pursuit of justice was assumed to be one of the major justifications for starting wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and was not being questioned in the way that the news was being framed. And that meant that there was a lot of an assumption in there about what intervention could achieve, that people were convincing themselves that regardless of the rights or the wrongs of the military activity, it would lead to a reconstruction phase that would rebuild Afghanistan, would rebuild Iraq, would make them more peaceful, more harmonious societies with democratic pluralist structures and vibrant economies someday. And from what I could see in the Balkans, that was never going to happen. All that would happen in the best case scenario was that the various factions that had been fighting each other would stop doing so for a little while. And in a really, really utopian scenario, the fact that they didn't fight for a very long time might mean they lost interest in starting again when the US disappeared. And, okay, that mightn't be a bad thing, but who was going to die in the process? How much was it going to cost? And who was going to actually pay for that? And who was going to profit from it as well? And those were questions that I thought should be being asked, and none of them were asked at all. And I wasn't able to ask them about the Balkans, let alone about Afghanistan or Iraq.
The reporting that the paper was interested in from you, in part, was sort of recreating the horrors of the wars that had already taken place. And you, at the time, found this really difficult to do because it felt, is sadistic too strong a word?
No, I think that is true. Yeah, I did find that I was basically asking people to, I think, as I say in the book, cry into my notebook. Mm-hmm. I was aware that there had been some horrendous atrocities perpetrated, and this was why there'd been such an interest in the Balkans. You know, in Europe, there hadn't been conflict since World War II, and I guess Europeans had started to convince themselves that they'd somehow evolved beyond the possibility of this sort of thing. Yeah. And there was this, you know, this terrible war that ripped Yugoslavia apart, started for very cynical motives and reasons by some people who played on some very legitimate grievances that festered in people's minds and resentments from earlier wars. But they didn't need to take place, those wars, and the things that people did to their neighbours were disgraceful. And obviously they shouldn't be forgotten, but we can't keep talking about these atrocities that happened day in, day out, years and years later. It seems somehow irrelevant. I mean, we would tell ourselves as journalists, I'm speaking, I guess, for some of my colleagues and thinking, you know, what they were thinking when they were asking for those stories, that we give people a chance to work through their grief and have a public arena for it, and in some ways to contribute to the pursuit of justice, to try and go after the people who have made them suffer in this way, and to bring them to justice, in this case, in a war crimes tribunal in The Hague. But I'm still waiting for the pages and pages of analysis of the grief and the suffering inflicted on the people of Iraq by the United States in the early part of the previous decade, and the case for bringing the US leaders who ordered that policy to justice at the International Criminal Court, or for the payment of reparations on the part of the United States government to Iraq for the terrible suffering that resulted from that policy of invasion. And so there's a very selective decision about whose suffering needs to be heard again and again and again. And I found it was this kind of mawkish obsession with the suffering of the Bosnian Muslims that I didn't disagree with. I mean, I didn't think it was wrong that we should pay attention to these people's suffering, but I did start to wonder why we had to keep repeating it in this way, and to go and ask the same people again and again and again why they were so frustrated about the injustice of their situation, because it wasn't going to change anything, and all I was doing was making them relive their unhappiness. And there was almost, in some cases, an impossibility for them to get beyond it. Who am I to tell them that they've got to stop grieving? I mean, there's no way I could do that. But at the same time, I didn't really want to be contributing to that process where they got stuck in their grief. And I gave them, you know, this window through which they could scream at the world. I just felt that there was something quite sordid about that, because it wasn't happening today, and we were digging it up, and I couldn't see why. It seemed so arbitrary, and as I say, unrelated to what was happening at the moment, that really did seem important to me. And I suppose I should just give some context at this point. And again, I stressed this in the book. This was what really, really freaked me out, was my job in that context was basically to ask why people in Serbia hadn't said sorry for the wars that they were deemed to have started, why they hadn't as a nation gone through this soul-searching process that asked, you know, a bit like Germans had done in the aftermath of World War II, why didn't we do more to stop this? And the suffering of these people was supposed to bring home what it was that they should have atoned for or apologized for. And at the same time as all of this, I'm working for a newspaper that's in the process of facilitating the starting of a war that doesn't need to happen. And the disconnect between those two things going on at the same time was just too much for me.
We'll talk about what you did about that in just a moment. My guest this hour is journalist Daniel Simpson. He is a one-time Balkans correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new memoir, A Rough Guide to the Dark Side. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former New York Times correspondent Daniel Simpson. His new memoir is called A Rough Guide to the Dark Side. He's in town for two different appearances. We have information about those on the Think page of KERA.org. One takes place this afternoon at the Mayborn School of Journalism at UNT. The other one is Sunday afternoon at the Writers Garret open house at Lucky Dog Books in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think at kera.org. Tell us about this sort of email run-in that you had with Judith Miller after you published a story questioning some reporting that suggested the Serbs were selling WMDs to Iraq.
Yeah, I suppose that was the moment at which I thought, this is absurd. I can't carry on working for this newspaper. As many listeners may be aware, Judith Miller was the journalist who is responsible for putting on the front page of the New York Times some of the more ridiculous claims about Iraq's weapons of mass non-existence, particularly nuclear weapons. And there had been a story in which she'd really, really pushed the boat out further than I think anybody else had ever tried, in which she was claiming that Iraq had stepped up its nuclear weapons program. And this was all based on information that was being fed to her by this complicated group of administration officials, intelligence agents, Iraqi exiles, and then some combination of the three in various front groups. And so she was talking to lots of different people and therefore could assure herself that she'd done, you know, an ethical job.
Any doubt in your mind, excuse me for interrupting, any doubt in your mind that she believed everything she reported?
I have no idea. I've never met her, and I know she's somebody who'd specialized in that field for a while, and she probably trusted her contacts. She's since said, when people have challenged her, look, you know, I can't be held responsible if the people I'm talking to give me false information. I took that information on good faith. But there was a lot of other information that she could have balanced that with, and a lot of due skepticism coming from all manner of sources about, I mean, just the realities of Iraq's weapons program. It had been inspected very intensively. The United States had been bombing Iraq pretty much, if not on a daily basis, certainly several times a week for 10 years to avoid the possibility of it reconstituting weapons programs, having an air force defending itself. And, in the end, there was a process underway at that time to try and check how much of this stuff that did once exist had been destroyed. And as I understand it, various defectors had pretty much substantiated the assumption that there wasn't a program that had been in process since about the mid-1990s, and whatever had remained from that program would be useless sludge by this stage. But still, I mean, there were claims being made. They had to probably be reported. I mean, I'm not suggesting that the New York Times has to ignore everything that comes out of the administration, but it just needs to be balanced with some skepticism and put into context. And the context it was being put into was, they want to go to war, and this is what's going to enable the war, and we're going to hype it up and make it a big enough story that Dick Cheney can pop up on Meet the Press and say, look, it's in the New York Times, it's true.
And so you wrote the skeptical piece, and she sent you an email and said what?
Well, I should probably explain that I was being hassled by the US Embassy in Belgrade to report this story, and the report that I eventually filed stuck to the facts, which was basically that there were some Serbs who were selling spare parts for planes that the Iraqis were going to put up into the sky to impede the US Air Force. The US didn't like this. There was also a ban on trading with Iraq, certainly when it came to weapons, and therefore they could have complained Serbs are in contravention of that ban. Instead, I was being encouraged to write about UAVs, WMD delivery systems, and various things that didn't actually get written in the Washington Post, and I was therefore under even more pressure to do what my competitors were doing and write that story. I wrote a plain vanilla story that said what I'd found, and that I couldn't find any evidence of a more intensive cooperation or any of these delivery systems that I was being told to look for. Judith Miller wrote to me and said that she had sources that said, actually, no, this was only the tip of the iceberg, and that I should carry on digging, and there were various people I should try calling because they would be able to tell me about the depth of this cooperation and the volumes of material that had been sold and what this potential UAV was capable of carrying, which in her claim was, I think, hundreds of kilograms of banned weapons agents. And she was very sure about this. And I just said, look, these are the reasons why I don't think that's true. She replied, I think we should keep pushing it. The Washington Post is all over it. You know, get onto the case. And I just didn't. I just decided I'm not going to write that.
Did you feel threatened by her in some way? I mean, she wasn't your supervisor, but she certainly had a lot of power at the paper.
Yeah, I mean, she was a star reporter. She was on the front page all the time writing these stories that were getting paid a lot of attention and that weren't being criticized at that time, apart from, you know, in obscure corners of the internet. I didn't feel very sure of myself. I was terrified. I actually remember getting that email. I was sitting in Tirana. I just arrived to report a story about Albania. And I didn't know what to say in response. I was on very shaky ground. At that time, I was also taking quite a lot of drugs. And my interest in my job was not what it might have been. I'd pretty much decided by this stage I'd had enough. I'd spent the weekend partying before the US Embassy had called me in to hear about these claims. I did what I could to substantiate them, but I was aware that there might be stuff out there that I didn't know, and perhaps I should call these people, and perhaps Judith Miller was right, and, you know, who was I? And in the end, I was a young guy, and I didn't really know about the whole process of producing chemical weapons, and perhaps I was wrong. And it's very easy when confronted by powerful people. I mean, this is just another journalist at my newspaper, but thinking about her position, being confronted by these, you know, very senior people in the US establishment and national security establishment at that, telling her about this stuff that's a matter of life and death, and her job is to report on that, very hard for her to say, you know what, I think, you know, you're pulling the wool over my eyes, and I'm gonna cite a load of claims that I've picked up on a skeptical left-wing website to balance your, you know, attempt to feed me classified information. I can see how hard it is to maintain your integrity in that position, and I felt a very small fraction of that where I was. But in the end, I just stuck to my guns and said, this is all I can find out, so I'm not going to write anything else.
So before very long, you decided to give your notice. You had some other ideas for what to do with your life that we'll talk about in a minute. And you had, I gather, assumed that you could sort of just ride out this time and file as necessary because they still owed you some money, so you didn't want to just flat quit. And then something highly unexpected takes place.
Well, I mean, it was actually very early on in my time at the Times. About 6 weeks into my time there, I was given the opportunity to spend a week at a music festival as part of my day job. There were some student protesters in Serbia who had basically pioneered something that we've seen a lot more of in more recent years in the Arab Spring protests, of organizing large gatherings of young people to get out in the streets and challenge a regime to send in the tanks or find some way of compromising to popular pressure. And in the end, this student protest movement had been a major factor in getting rid of Slobodan Milosevic as the president of Yugoslavia. And he was then shipped off to The Hague to a war crimes tribunal. And the guys who'd been involved in that whole process were now doing other things. Some of them had become businessmen, but some of them were trying to find a way of carrying on this idealism. And they had set up a music festival called Exit. And that music festival, like the student protesters, was receiving a lot of funding from the United States government, because the US likes to have people in foreign countries who are closely aligned with American thinking and who one day will be the next generation of politicians who might therefore implement policies that are favorable to the US. I mean, that's how foreign policy works. I got wind of this and thought that's a great way to justify spending a week at a music festival and writing a story about what became of the student protest movement. When I met these guys, I was really impressed. I thought, when they started, I mean, they were my age pretty much, and here was I feeling already that I was at a newspaper that wasn't quite what I'd hoped it would be. There wasn't space to file stories. I mean, this one I wrote about the music festival had to wait a month to turn up in the paper, even though it was something that my editors sounded interested in. And I thought, you know, what they're trying to achieve sounds on paper fantastic. But I met a guy who'd been working with them who, like me in the New York Times, was getting disillusioned with the people he was involved with. And he told me that actually everything they were telling me was nonsense and that they were pulling the wool over their own eyes. And really, they wanted to become the next generation of Serbian politicians. They didn't want to organize some revolutionary shift in Balkan consciousness and bring about a more democratic society where people from all these different republics that had gone to war became friends again. And basically started some sort of Balkan summer of love. He said they were just out for ways to advance their own careers, and so he wanted to do something that was sincerely trying to achieve these objectives. And at that time, as I say, I was smoking quite a bit of cannabis, I sat down with him, we talked a lot, and I thought, you know, I don't want to be involved with my employers because they don't seem very interested in any of the things that I thought they were setting out to achieve. Perhaps the two of us together could turn our disillusionment in a positive direction, put on a rival festival in the centre of Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, as opposed to out in the provinces where this other event had taken place, book a whole load of bands and bring hundreds of thousands of people onto this island in the middle of the Danube called Big War Island, where we would really start a summer of love and completely reinvent the nature of Serbia and the reputation of Serbia in the outside world. It would become a place that would attract young people from all over Europe. It would start a whole new tourist industry, supplanting Ibiza as the main destination where young people in Western European countries go in the summertime to listen to music and take drugs. And, I mean, I even convinced myself that we could somehow persuade the Serbian government to decriminalise soft drugs as part of this policy, and it would engineer a huge amount of investment. There'd be all these trade flows. And suddenly there'd be this reconnection, because for most young people growing up in Serbia, they were led to believe that they were the scum of Europe. Their country was isolated. Even when I was living there, it was still, you know, 2-3 years after the last war, impossible to use a credit card on the internet. Yugoslavia was on a blacklist. I couldn't have books shipped to me from Amazon. And they'd had this vibrant counterculture that was unlike anything in Eastern Europe throughout the Cold War years, to the extent that they had punk bands that British music papers would write about in the 1980s. But that had all died in the 1990s. Alternative culture had been suppressed by the Milosevic regime, and really this energy that had been kept alive in the student protests, which was very creative channeling of graphic design, music, almost like the Situationists of 1968. They were really making people think by what they were doing, and I loved that energy, and I thought we could somehow revive that by staging this thing. It was almost as if all the ley lines, these kind of, you know, strange psychic forces would line up, and suddenly there would be this transformation, and we could engineer it, I thought. And I think that was evidence of just how deluded I was at that time and how much I was smoking.
You know what's really interesting, though, Daniel, is that, and your book is called A Rough Guide to the Dark Side. In some ways, there's a really interesting sort of mirror image effect of your sort of belief that this festival could work, that it was the right thing, that you could uncritically trust your partner in all of this, and this would change the world. It's a strange sort of polar mirror image to what you are telling us was going on at the time.
Yeah, the levels of my naivety were staggering, and I think that was because I just really wanted to believe in what it was that I was engaged in. And there were lots of different reasons for that, one of which, I mean, probably the chief one, if I'm really honest with myself, was that I'd spent the previous 10 years of my life trying to get ahead. You know, I'd worked hard at school, I'd gone to Cambridge University, I got a fancy job as a trainee at Reuters, I'd been headhunted by the New York Times, no less, my ego was going through the ceiling. And suddenly, I was unable to feed it, and I didn't really know who I was. And I thought, well, if I'm actually going nowhere in life in terms of, you know, career advancement, perhaps I should rewind to where I was in my late teens and do all the things I never let myself do, like spend a lot of time at music festivals and take more drugs than I thought was sensible. And so I did all those things, and that led me wide-eyed into admiration for people like the guy I was working with, who totally fearlessly walked around town saying, I'm going to run a music festival. I don't care if I've got the money to do it. I don't care who gets offended by what it is that I'm going to do. I don't care who comes along and points a gun at me and tells me they're going to steal all my money. I'm just going to do it because that's the right thing. His recklessness, let's say, but to my mind, fearlessness was incredibly impressive, and it was a symbol of all the things that I lacked in my attempt to do what was expected of me as a journalist, and that I could see around me in all my peers who were trying to impress and trying to stay on the right side of things, not offend the powerful people who they depended on for their information, make sure that their career kept advancing and that they got promoted, as opposed to offending the wrong person and winding up out on their ear. I mean, the irony of all this is Judith Miller is still making a lot of money and has almost rehabilitated herself as a paragon of journalistic ethics by going to jail a few years later for refusing to reveal the name of a source. But I digress. I mean, back to me in this whole situation. Yeah, it was incredibly naive. And I think the real thing that got under my skin was that everything I'd been doing at the paper just seemed to add up to misrepresenting things in a way that was destructive. And so I probably overcompensated by misrepresenting in a way that I hoped would be constructive. I dreamed up all this hype. I invented a new name for myself, Raoul Dukanovich, ripped off from Hunter S. Thompson's pseudonym Raoul Duke, a Balkan version. I used that to write to the newspaper and say all the things that they wouldn't let me write in, under my own byline in a letter that they published much faster than most of my stories. I used Mr. Raoul Dukanovich's name on all of my promotional materials. I set up meetings with my New York Times contacts in which I purported to interview them, and then in the middle of the conversation switched to showing them a brochure for the festival and asking them for money for it. I mean, I just had this dream that I really, really wanted to make come true. And no matter how much evidence I got from the world that suggested it was very implausible, not least the fact that none of these people who I asked for money under the guise of being interviewed for the New York Times did anything other than summon their press attaché to get rid of me.
Yeah, isn't it surprising that no one called?
I'm amazed. I'm still amazed that I got away with all of that, yeah. I mean, it shows me actually perhaps what one could get away with as a New York Times journalist offending powerful people. I mean, I'm sure you write something in the paper. Let's say, for sake of argument, March 2003, as opposed to writing as the Times did in flowery prose that the United States was engaged in its bombing of Baghdad in some overseas adventure of the largest sort since Vietnam. If it instead said the United States defied international opinion or the international community, no less, last night and launched a war of aggression that was morally equivalent to anything that senior Nazis had eventually been hanged for, you know, they would obviously have got a very, very, very rude call very quickly from the White House, but they could do some slightly lesser things and get away with it, I think. In the end, that's what being a journalist is about, having a thick skin and holding people in power to account and not being afraid to offend them.
We're speaking this hour with former New York Times correspondent Daniel Simpson. His new memoir is called A Rough Guide to the Dark Side. We will take your calls after this break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Daniel Simpson, the one-time correspondent for the New York Times, who is author of the new memoir, A Rough Guide to the Dark Side. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have Josh on the line now in Richardson. Hello, Josh.
Hi. I'm going to warn you, I'm going to be slightly critical here. I'm wondering when exactly Mr. Simpson got the memo telling him that he no longer had to report the news, but instead promote his own personal agenda. And if he wanted to criticize other writers' work like Ms. Miller, who it sounds a little bit like you're jealous of her, why not just become an editor instead and work from inside instead of actively deceiving the management and the readers? And then lastly, did you return all the money that Reuters paid you or the New York Times paid you when you decided the people you were working for were trying to manufacture wars? That's my questions.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Those are good questions. I've tried to be as honest as I can in writing this book, and the first thing that I would say is that I don't try to defend what I did. I am trying to explain why I felt at that time that those were the right things to do, but I'm very aware, and it's, I could say painfully aware, that I don't have an ethical leg to stand on if I'm going to start throwing stones. And I felt that the only way that I could in some way do any criticizing of other people with any degree of sincerity was if I was prepared to criticize myself as unstintingly as possible in the process.
Talk about this. The final stories that you reported, not only were you fabricating quotes, but you were like, oh, I don't want to go out to the scene. And you flipped on the TV and thought that'll be good enough.
I mean, I should preface all this with a little bit of clarification. Firstly, a lot of what one reads in the New York Times or sees on TV is not actually originally reported by the reporters whose names go on that work. It's taken from wire services. And all I was doing when I got lazy was relying more on the wire service than I might otherwise have done if I'd gone out and interviewed the people that the wire service had interviewed. Again, that doesn't defend those things. I mean, ideally, every piece of news should be reported firsthand by the person whose name is on that story. But that's not what happens every day. And so I just wanted to clarify that, first of all. Secondly, the incident in which I did fabricate a quotation and then went on in another couple of stories to do the same thing involved me basically taking what was being said by other people and giving those words to a fake name. Again, that's totally indefensible. I mean, those sort of ethical transgressions have really no justification.
Do you think it happens a lot? Do you think you're an isolated
case? No, I think
it
happens. I think it happens an enormous amount. I mean, there was a huge scandal over Jason Blair's transgressions. Yeah. I mean, they became serial in which he was pretending to be where he wasn't, and that was a whole new level of things. But I mean, if you read the actual things that the Times wrote about what they discovered when they were investigating what he'd done, he was taking information from wire services. Or he was taking quotations that had been given to other media and pretending they'd been given to him. Now, that sort of thing goes on all the time. People sometimes explain where they've taken their information from, but not often. Certainly, I mean, the basis on which I was hired by the New York Times was because they'd used my stories when I was reporting for Reuters from Macedonia and used them as the basis of their foreign reporting, and they thought I'd done a good job, so they hired me. To go back to the original questions, I mean, firstly, I was being asked if I'd returned all the money I'd been paid by these organizations that I'm critical of. No, I haven't. And I don't think that's really my duty. I certainly think it would be unethical of me now to take their money while being rude about them. At that time, when I was being paid by them, I was doing a job for which I was paid. And with the New York Times, I was being paid a salary to send them stories on a regular basis. I did carry on sending them stories on a regular basis. I sent them as many stories as they would print. I tried to do that job as well as I could, despite in the early phases realizing that it wasn't one that I was very keen on. The problem was that they didn't want to print those stories, and they didn't have an interest in the sort of stories that I thought would be of interest to their readers, so I gave up. But I continued honouring my contractual obligations. It just so happened that by the end of the whole story, I was in the middle of trying to do something else. And at that time, I'd given my notice. I'd resigned from the paper. The problem was that the Serbian Prime Minister got shot in the centre of Belgrade in the period when I was serving out my notice. I had no alternative but to write about that news. But I would actually, at that moment, just got off a plane from Berlin where I was trying to promote my music festival. And I had to produce front page story in a great hurry, and I cut every corner I knew how to cut to do that. And I don't defend that at all. And that's why I've tried to hold up my hands and say I did wrong. But what I've also tried to do is explain why I suddenly felt that really was not that big a deal. And the reason for that was the degree to which so many people at that newspaper over the time that I worked for them had gone to such lengths to misrepresent the reality of what was happening with the United States foreign policy, and that led to people dying, whereas me taking what my translator had said about the death of Zoran Djindjic and attributing it to a fake name didn't seem to be that big a deal by contrast.
Talk about what happened with Echo.
Well, it was in the end not a great success, certainly
weather,
from my
no
point
money.
Of view. Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, it was a glorious success. There was a festival in the centre of Belgrade. A lot of people came and had a very good time. And over the course of these 4 days, we had about 150,000 visitors. I mean, how many of them came again and again, it's hard to say, but there were 150,000 people on site. That's a lot of people, and that was a big event, and that did change consciousness in Belgrade temporarily, in the sense that people were exposed to music that would not otherwise have been there, and they enjoyed it, and that created the sense that these sort of things were possible, gave other people ideas about doing other things. And so on one level, it was a very positive influence. But I could only really see the other side of the story from behind the scenes, which was because we hadn't raised any cash to run the thing, we'd had to talk people into working for free on the understanding they'd get paid after the event. And at the end of the event, there was no money. Now, to this day, and you know, again, this will be evidence of my own journalistic inadequacies at that time, I have no idea what happened. You know, in the story of my own life, I'm reliant on what people tell me, and I haven't been able to substantiate their various claims because they're all conflicting. But the upshot of it all was that there was no money left. So 150,000 people turned up on site, somehow got onto the island, somehow got past our very well-armed security, and somehow got drunk over the course of 4 days without spending money in the bars. So somebody stole the cash. Who they were, I don't know. The obvious candidates were either my business partners or the guys we employed as our security. And I've heard very many different claims as to who did the stealing. But in the end, it looks like the combination of getting involved with some dodgy characters you know, among my partners, who were friends with the security and who helped the security to potentially get involved with letting people in for free, or at least for backhanders, seems to have led to a state where there was a massive amount of outstanding debts, very angry people, and not a lot of positive energy spread by this event at all. In fact, there were a lot of people phoning me up saying, you know, you've cheated us, you've stolen the cash, and in fact, we know that you're a renegade British agent, and this whole thing was a scam in which you and your business partners, who are Balkan ecstasy kingpins and money launderers for the Croat mafia, are using the innocent, naive young people of Belgrade for your own twisted ends. And by that stage of my life, I was at the point where I was thinking, well, maybe they're right. You know, I really don't know anything anymore. I just know that I feel like a fraud, and I feel very disappointed both in myself and in this sequence of events that led to this. But in the process of writing my book, I've come to understand why that outcome was pretty much inevitable. I mean, I start the book by saying it's a story about fate. And I like to think that I'm a rationalist and that I believe very strongly in my own free will. But the extent to which a lot of my actions were predestined, and a lot of the outcomes that resulted were predestined, was alarming to me when I started to look back over time and see the sequence of cause and effect that led to these things. My own desperate desire to believe in this project that was really flawed from the outset was the architect of my undoing. And it's been a difficult process of coming to terms with that, just as it has with these questions about journalism. The other thing that I was being asked was, if I really disagree with things, would it not have been better to try and become an editor, or to try and change the way that the paper worked? I mean, I'd love to have done that, but let's be honest. The New York Times at that time had, you know, a very clear sense of its role. And I mean, the editor, Hal Raines, who was forced out over the Jason Blair scandal, said very clearly in an article for The Atlantic Monthly in 2004 that the Times existed to be the indispensable newsletter of the United States political, diplomatic, governmental, academic and professional communities. Its job is basically to foghorn propaganda on behalf of the powerful. Now, me going in there and saying, well, actually, I think we should be some sort of radical muckraking scandal sheet designed to unseat every attempt by the United States government to go to war, unless it can prove that we're actually under threat of being invaded ourselves. Well, I'm not going to get very far with that project, evidently. And so once I realized these things, I just thought I shouldn't really be there. Then, of course, we can say, well, why did I stay there for 6 months being paid, doing the bare minimum? Yeah, of course, you know, I hold my hands up and say that I didn't do the right thing there, but I'd like to know how many other people can hold their hands up in all sincerity and say they've always done the right thing in their lives. And I think we don't generally, as a species, never mind as a profession in the media, ask ourselves enough soul-searching questions about whether we're doing the right thing and whether actually there are things that we ought to change about our behaviour. And I've since found that very important. I've been through a period of quite a lot of soul searching, trying to decide what to do with myself after this event. And the process of writing my book and getting on with reporting about very different things, most recently mainly about yoga, which I've been studying and trying to embody in a not always successful way in my life, has led me to place, you know, a lot of value on honesty and you know, ethical sincerity, and I'm, you know, I'm not in any way defending what I did, but at the same time, I have some affection for my younger self and can see why I got myself into those predicaments, and I've tried to tell the story in a way that does justice to those things and tells the story of the fun adventure I had at that time in my life. And I'm glad that I was able to follow my heart and do what seemed to me the important thing, even if it was disastrous, totally misguided, and deserving of opprobrium from right-thinking members of the Texas citizenry.
You sit here before me looking healthy and emotionally stable. The end of the book does not give us any clues about how you are, except to the extent that we realize that you've been able to complete a book. You sort of end with this drug-fueled rant. your friends are calling up and trying to sort of get you together, and you're resistant to that. Why leave us there at the end of this work?
I mean, I think the simplest answer is I wanted to tell a straightforward story of my undoing and what it had done to my understanding of myself and the world at large. And that's why I called it A Rough Guide to the Dark Side, and that's why I structured it the way that I did. I mean, it's basically a tragedy. I say at the beginning that it's all going to go horribly wrong, and then you carry on reading and get staggered by the extent to which it does. And, you know, I'm not giving anything away by saying that. In keeping with my tradition of shameless ripoffs, stole the structure from the nine circles of hell in Dante's Inferno, and I go deeper and deeper into them, and at the very end, I lose my mind. And that's what happened. I mean, I basically went psychotic for several days due to taking too many drugs, not sleeping, and being so deeply conflicted in myself over all these things that I'd done. And feeling, frankly, racked with guilt, and not really knowing how to process that except by getting more wasted. And that was clearly not very sustainable. But the outcome of all that was to have my head explode. And I felt that any attempt to then sort of say, oh, and then I picked myself up and, you know, slowly went back to the United Kingdom, spent all my savings on a strange combination of strong cannabis and psychotherapy until I realized I probably should get another job and got established doing things that I wasn't so keen on while trying to be an activist in my spare time, and then took up some yoga, and you know, it became a very long story in itself and not really the one I wanted to tell here. I wanted to tell, as I say, the story about how I lost my illusions. And at the end of it, I become aware that the whole fabric of reality is disintegrating in front of me, both in my mind and in my personal history, and that actually I had no certainty about any of the events in my own life. And I became actually at that point aware of one very, very important truth. And it was that all these things that I was criticizing in the world around me, these journalists who were getting up my nose, I was embodying myself. And perhaps that's why they annoyed me so much. And as I say, I think, you know, if we could see the problems starting in ourselves and try to address them before pointing the finger at others, we might live in a better world.
The new book by Daniel Simpson is called A Rough Guide to the Dark Side. He will speak this afternoon at the Mayborn School of Journalism at UNT and on Sunday at 2 at a Writer's Garret open house at Lucky Dog Books in Dallas. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about Think and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.